Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. Join me as I seek out the small incremental changes being applied in other industries that we can learn from and that can be applied in healthcare. Can these changes bring immediate value, but also add up to the big improvements and revolution we need in healthcare? Come along with me to explore the possibilities. My innovative guests from around the globe have used small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot.
And today, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Emad Rizik. He is the president and CEO of Cotiviti. Emad, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Nick.
So as I do with all of my guests, I think it's worth understanding a little bit of your background. You're a physician, but you've had lots of other experiences. Tell us a little bit about your journey to get to this point and this organization, if you would.
Sure. First, I do want to thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to meet you. I've been on the administrative side of medicine, I think, probably for the last 20 years or so, in various capacities, mostly in research and then in the payer and the provider world. So I bring kind of multiple perspectives from research, from the provider perspective in terms of payments and managing providers, and also from the payer in terms of managing networks and payment for services rendered. Over the last 5 years, we invested into a company called Versend. And Versend is really at the core was an analytics company. And that started around 2016. And then in the next 2 to 3 years, we really just had sort of a roll-up strategy where we acquired many organizations with different capabilities, but at its core was healthcare IT and analytics. And then we, in 2018, we bought a company called Cotiviti. We merged the two organizations, and now we're one of the largest, if not the most premier payment accuracy organization in the country.
So payment accuracy, that sort of, you know, generates a lot of interest, obviously a hot topic at this point in our healthcare journey. We struggle with that, certainly in the United States. I can't comment too much on other countries, but I know there's pretty much plenty of people that are listening to this show that go, but there's no accuracy in any of the bills that I've ever received. You've obviously got some secret sauce. Tell us a little bit about what's going on at Cotiviti.
Sure. It's interesting. Payment actually, although I say we're a very large payment accuracy company, but when you look at payment accuracy, there are multiple dimensions to payment. And your viewership and your listeners should understand that it's not just a financial transaction. It also has a great deal of clinical perspective. So you don't pay just for services rendered. You pay for services depending on the risk associated with that procedure, how sick the patient is, whether they're a level one or a level two or a level three. And then also you pay on the outcomes and the quality outcomes. True payment has to take all those three into play. And so when I say we're a large payment accuracy company, what makes us so good is the fact that we do a lot of risk stratification and risk understanding and risk assessment. We also have a lot of products that measure quality and measure network efficiency. So by combining those three things, we can actually get a 360 view on the most accurate way to pay for a specific procedure at a point in time.
So as you think about that for organizations, from a patient perspective, you know, what are the key elements that really contribute to that accuracy? I mean, you talk about the broad groupings, but what is it in there that really makes the difference? I mean, we see some incredible variation in, you know, the numbers that come out from hospitals. Some of it relates to discounts. So, you know, I guess put that to one side because that's all about negotiated rates. But what does it come to, you know, why are we doing such a poor job?
It's a great question. And I'm not sure that I can actually have a logical, predictable answer for you. Mm-hmm. I think you will find a lot that has to do, if you're an academic medical center, that you're seeing higher index, higher risk patients, obviously you're getting paid at a different level. if you are a single provider in a community hospital and you're the only provider of orthopedic services and you can't find another orthopedic surgical center for another 25 to 30 miles, well, obviously you're getting paid a little bit more. So I don't believe that at this point in time, we are at a national basis of reference pricing or reference billing that says all orthopedic hip transplants in non-complicated patients should cost between X and Y. That would not be a bad thing to have some of that, but we're far from that. It is still very different based on hospital, geography, center, level of care, complexity that takes place during that, and whether it's in an urban or a community environment.
So you have an international perspective. Are other countries doing a better job? I mean, I think there's a mischaracterization of healthcare. You know, other countries don't pay for it. It's free, but it's not, right? I mean, that's just correct. Not the case. They just pay for it in different ways. Are they better at it? And if they are, is there anything that they're doing that we can learn from?
They're actually not. And that's a
how disappointing.
Yes. It's a bit of a fallacy in the sense that somehow socializing medicine and reference pricing is always better. And folks say it's free healthcare. It's completely free. There's no such thing as free, obviously. And obviously we have something here that not a lot of countries do have, as you know. If you wanted to get a hip replaced or a knee replaced and you wanted it in the next week, you could get that done. You know, that's not necessarily what would occur in country A or country B or country C. You know, there's a waiting list for that to happen. You might not have a choice of which hospital to go to. You might not have a choice of which physician is going to be. So it depends on what you give up for that access to care and whether you give up choice. But for us here, what's very important, I do believe we have one of the best private healthcare industry in the world, because you also see in other countries that many folks are opting out of the socialized and moving into more private care. As a matter of fact, it's one of the fastest growing pieces of healthcare, is many people buying insurance to supplement their social health.
Wow, I think you give everybody a little bit of pause for thought when you describe both the lack of success around that. I would have just assumed that there would be more sort of understanding, maybe a little bit disappointing, but probably not that surprising in hindsight.
I would say, Nick, if I could just interrupt, it depends on the lens that you see it. It's not as, I wouldn't judge it as disappointing. I would just say there are trade-offs in almost everything. If you want choice, significant choice on time frame, on who the physician is, on where you want a procedure done, and you want that, you will probably have to pay extra for that. If it is irrelevant for you and you don't mind those and you're willing to forego that decision to someone else who can make it, then you would be okay for you to have that type of care.
Interesting.
But I think as an American community, we are kind of a bit impatient around what we want.
And we pay an appropriate premium for that impatience.
A significant premium.
And importantly, I think a premium for the choice that some people feel is an imperative in the American way, I guess, is I want to be able to choose the source and, you know, the physician, even the location. So, you know, that explains a fair amount of that price differential.
And we do have a choice now. And I think that's the one thing what we speak too much around rhetoric of everything's broken, but we have a very successful private healthcare insurance business that has great outcomes. You know, when you compare the managed Medicare to, you know, fee-for-service Medicare, when you compare managed Medicaid the fee-for-service Medicaid, when you manage the commercial, we've had a very effective private insurance. And as a Medicare recipient or as a Medicaid recipient, you have a choice. You could get it through CMS, or you could get it through supplemental through the healthcare insurance companies. And the healthcare insurance companies have kept their prices very low and have had all the contracts with the providers, and all the payment contracts are there, and they have the network that you could choose from. So I think our healthcare system gets a bad rap.
I'm sure of that. I think we get a bad rap all of the time because we're held up, you know, as a negative in many instances. And you're right, there are lots of positives and we do pay a premium, but those positives are some of the things that people desire and they're willing to pay for those premiums.
Correct.
And, you know, I think it's extraordinarily important to point that out on occasion because it's easy to look across and, you know, as they say, the grass is always greener on the other side. But when I don't know about you, but I've lived in those other systems and they are not the perfection that people seem to think they are. For certain, they have, you know, their holes. So as we think about the change that occurred, I mean, we just had this extraordinary and devastating pandemic sweep across. It's really changed the face of healthcare. It's amplified all sorts of problems. And, you know, from a financial standpoint, I think it's wreaked devastation across many groups. Tell us a little bit about your understanding in that space and what you think is going to come out of that.
I just gave a small talk to all of our customers and our clients last week about that. The pandemic had basically, it did not identify any new fault line. It actually accentuated all of our already existing fault lines. We have a lot of fault lines in healthcare in many ways. Number one, at the highest level, the disparity in data and interoperability between data. Everybody sits on their own data kingdom. You have the provider sitting on data. You have the payers sitting on data. The government sits on data. So there's all this disparate data. You have a supply chain data. You know, Nick, they have their own data, and you have a risk data. Even for us, why we excelled and we were one of the top companies that helped save the world from COVID save lives from COVID was the fact that we were able to bring that clinical data, that financial data, that risk data, that payment data, that quality data. So we had no interoperability at the highest level in the country between all the different mechanisms of healthcare. And so when the pandemic hit, it found every fault line, Nick, and just drove it home. And I'll kind of give you an example why. The second part, that data, that disparity of data directly translates to care. If you do not identify populations that are high at risk for X, Y, and Z, for diabetes, for hypertension, if you don't proactively find them, those were the populations that were the most susceptible to the pandemic. And when you look at the response level of the country between February, March, April, and May, it is the infection rate went really high and the death rate went almost just as high, up to like 7% in some areas. But we knew which population were at risk. We knew that it was the elderly. We knew that it was the comorbid population. We knew that there was racial disparities, not just racial disparities in access to care, but racial disparities because of racial predisposition to illnesses, to hypertensives and to diabetes. You know, my culture is very prone to hypertension and to diabetes. So obviously, you have to be extra careful for that. So we didn't identify these patients right up front, which predominantly was about 60 to 70 to 80% of all deaths. The interesting thing what happened is we got our act together in May, June, July, and August. And so we went through our second wave, and then we went through our third wave in the fall. Each one of those waves had less associated percentage of death with it. And it was all because we all got together. We started to share data. We wanted the providers, the payers, the supply chain, everybody got together. All the CEOs, both public and private organizations, got together. And we said, we have to share data immediately.
So for those of you just joining, I'm Dr. Nick, the incrementalist. Today, I'm talking to Dr. Emad Rizik. He is the president and CEO of Cotiviti. We were just talking about the COVID-19 impact and the multiple waves. And the message I heard clearly from what you just said was that the cooperation was really part of the prevailing solution that helped us really suppress the ongoing effect. And, you know, as you think about that from a financial and, you know, the sharing of data, do we have a pathway to better sharing, better interoperability, or are we still going to live in these islands where people know this is my data, I'm not willing to share it?
I think we made some very strong strides, Nick, this past year. I believe there was a lot of sacred cows that were just sacrificed because many of us wanted to hold on to that data and many organizations had to. And so we actually wind up, many of the CEOs and myself and others on the provider side, we wrote a sort of a roadmap on how the public and the private sector can work together for disaster planning. And it's out there through the Healthcare Leadership Council. And so we put it out there, and I was one of the authors of it, myself and Judy of Epic. And so we said what interoperability is required for future pandemics. But many of us also looked back at everything that we've learned over this last year, and we've gathered our data and we've become a lot smarter. Like one thing that we mentioned is around payment. You can't just make payment based on a financial perspective. You have to have very robust data to try to make payment to make sure that the payment's the most accurate way upfront versus after you pay to come back and try to get it. For us, our data, we sit on about 145 million data elements of people, longitudinal records, that has a lot of clinical data and has a lot of risk associated with it, has the providers, has the patients. So now what we do is we make a very educated decision on how much we pay in an accurate way. So we don't have to go back to that provider and say, sorry, we made a mistake. We need a refund, because nobody wants that.
So I you get to the crux of much of this, which is that sort of exchange at the end of the process. And I think that's where, you know, that's one of the sweet spots for you, is that process of removing that wasteful spending, that wasteful exchange that sort of essentially leaves money on the table. It's unrecovered. Tell us, how's that working? What are you doing, and what's that contributing to the overall process?
So the magnitude of waste is, whichever article we read or your viewers want to read, this has been identified as far back as 10 years by the Institute of Medicine. And the Institute of Medicine said that almost 50% was wasteful at that time. Generally speaking, it's somewhere between $600 to about $900 billion a year of wasteful spending. Now, that's a big bucket. Obviously, can we create efficiencies around that? Of course, but not for all of it. But generally speaking, we're about $3.5 trillion all of healthcare. If 600 billion of it or 700 billion is wasteful, and by the year 2028, we're going to get to $6.5 trillion. Using the same ratio, we will be well over $1.5 trillion of waste. And so, how do we stop that waste? And from my perspective, I really do believe it is the conglomeration of data, the 360 view of information around patients, providers, and illness. So as an example, a quick example, if I was to go and get a hip transplant, and I am a hypertensive, but I am a managed hypertensive, and so that payment will be X. I will know that upfront because there will be a medical record that understands that. There will be a quality indicators around how my hypertension needs to be get to manage prior to that. Now, so I will be managed. I will be predictable. I will understand exactly what happens. As a matter of fact, after I have my hip replaced, the first thing they're going to make sure is that my heart's fine, my blood pressure is good, nothing's okay. Or if I was a diabetic, it'd be the same thing. Now, if I was unidentified and I just went in and they just managed me and all of a sudden I have an event during the surgery, a heart event or a vascular event, then all of a sudden the appropriate precautions and predictability did not take place. The physician did not do that. So we are trying to move all that information as far forward as possible. So there's a predictability, not just in payment, but also in care. Because I believe that payment is care. Because if you could redeploy that 600 to 800 billion of waste, you could just imagine the communities we could outreach to, the potential disparity in care that exists by putting mobile outreach to that. So there is definitely, I see it as a quality, not just as a financial.
Interesting. So a couple of minutes remaining. As you think about the future, we're emerging from the pandemic, however that sort of plays out. We've got, you know, as you described it, you know, existing fault lines. So this wasn't new. It just sort of amplified, exposed it. It sounds like there's been some real progress in terms of potential pathways to help resolve some of this. Where do we go from here? How do we seal up those fault lines and fix some of this so that we're not going back and saying, well, why is this still the case?
Well, we're definitely not going to go back. I believe that the fault lines that were amplified created scars. And I think those scars have left their imprint on us. I believe HHS, the public and the private sector will work together with interoperability. I believe there'll be collaboration a lot more with organization. And we've now recognized the importance of data and how proactive data needs to be upfront. And I don't think, and we now see that even in different levels of care, like telehealth and home health and all of this. So absolutely, we are a different healthcare industry moving forward.
I'm delighted to hear that. I know everybody else will be. I think, you know, there's a little voice bit inside me that's going, I sure hope we don't try and return to the original system. But I think you're right. You know, that exposure has forced us to rethink this. And allow people to see the value of that cooperation, the sharing of the data. You know, I'm hopeful, as you are, that we can turn that waste into beneficial utility for medical treatment. So just remains for me to thank you for joining me. It's been a real pleasure. Imad, thanks for joining me on the show.
Thank you very much, Dick. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for joining me today. Do you have any better ideas, or have you found a small incremental change that's brought about a big improvement in your world? Let's continue the conversation on our hashtag, The Incrementalist, or share with me at DrNick1 on Twitter. You can find more information about the show on our program page at healthcarenowradio.com. And tune in next time to hear my discussions with leaders and innovators from around the globe who've revolutionized their space by using small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. I'm Dr. Nick, The Incrementalist, and I'm starting a revolution through evolution.